This is the As We Go podcast, a supplemental series in partnership with the Gospel Church. We want to explore how we proclaim the good news in the everyday stuff of life. My name is Tanner, the discipleship pastor at the Gospel Church, and today I'm talking with Pastor Cole Huffman, the lead pastor at the Gospel Church. Together, we will explore how we interpret our current cultural context well. This episode is produced in conjunction with our upcoming class, Invitational Life, Sharing the Gospel Well. We pray that it'll be a blessing and encouragement to you. Welcome to the As We Go podcast. I'm here with Pastor Cole. Cole, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, I'm excited that you're here, and I'm excited about our topic. We'll be exploring today how to exegete our current cultural context, or in other words, how do we understand the place in which we are living and the people in it so that we can best proclaim the good news of Jesus. This, I think, is vitally important. We learn lots of ways how to share the gospel, methods, tools, but we often learn a pre-packaged thing that is often irrespective of the people that we're talking to. So it's important that we learn our cultural landscape so that we may communicate the gospel. There is an author by the name of Michael Green who wrote a book on the evangelism in the early church. And he talks about their flexibility in the approach of proclaiming the good news. And he says this, much of the variety talking about evangelism will have been necessitated by the needs and understanding of the hearers. Evangelism is never proclamation in a vacuum, but always to people, and the message must be given in terms that make sense to them, in ways in which they can receive this good news that we're talking about. So Cole, if I were to sort of put this back onto you when we look at culture and interpreting it, why do you believe that it is so important that we interpret the culture well so that we can communicate the gospel well?
Well, I think part of it's just common courtesy. You know, I don't think you just want to start speaking at people. You want to have a conversation with someone. The gospel is an invitational message. And part of being invitational is respecting where the other person is coming from. So I'm a big proponent of asking questions, trying to understand what motivates this person, what are their desires, what are their fears and concerns, if we can get on that topic with them. It's not that we're changing the gospel message when we're doing cultural exegesis. We're trying to understand who this person in front of me is. What has he or she been shaped by? What are they thinking about? And the gospel is a message that I can, it's wonderfully adaptive. It's timeless, and the content of it doesn't change, but you can find angles as you listen to people on here's where their concerns are. You know, I think one of the things that becomes important in this, for instance, is if you're talking to somebody and you find out that they're really motivated by self-improvement. You ask them questions about that. You try to figure out what do they mean by self-improvement. But you also have a sense, you know, because you're informed by the gospel, you think about Paul's teaching in Romans 7 that we're split. You know, we kind of have this Jekyll Hyde in our personality. And so we can be people who want self-improvement, but we also have this potential for self-sabotage, and the gospel speaks to that quite well. And so if you're listening to somebody talk about self-improvement, perhaps, and their desire for that, then you ask them, well, do you ever find that you're not able to accomplish the things that you want to, and what do you do with that? And that's, you're clearing the way. I think that's a lot of what cultural exegesis is trying to do, is what are the hurdles, what are the hang-ups, what are the presumptions or assumptions this person has? How do I get down to that so that I know then when I've listened to them, and I think that's a big part of it, and I have an understanding of where they're coming from, now how do I fit or tailor the gospel to where they are? it is the gospel. I'm not reinventing it. But it's almost kind of like what a tailor does with a suit. If you go into a suit store and you buy a suit, the tailor's going to have to make adjustments based on your shoulder width and your waist size and how long your legs are. And that's kind of what we're doing. We're taking this old suit that is the gospel message, the good news of what Jesus has done for us as sinners, and we're tailoring it to people as we find them, helping them understand themselves in light of the gospel.
Yeah, I think that's really good. There's a missiologist by the name of Lamine Sané who really argues that the power of the gospel is found in its translatability, that's really what sets it apart from other faiths and religions, that over the course of the past 2,000 years, that the gospel has been translated to different cultures and different languages in a way that makes sense to the people so that they can receive it and understand the message.
Well, I remember something Stanley Hauerwas said from a theologian from Duke Divinity School, that for the longest time we thought that our role was to make the gospel intelligible to people, when really it is to help people understand that they really will never understand themselves without the gospel.
Yeah, that's really good. I think that speaks to the deeper understandings or ideas of worldview, especially when you look at culture. Anthropologists will break culture down into lots of different ways. They'll talk about cognitive dimensions, affective dimensions, evaluative dimensions, talking about behavior, ideas, and beliefs. But really underlying all of those things is worldview. There's a missiologist by the name of Charles Kraft who defines worldview as the deep level of culture. It is the way that the culture is structured, its set of assumptions, underlying how a people perceive and respond to reality. What is that thing deep down that is driving something, that is defining their allegiances and their values? That's their worldview. But we have a tendency in the Christian faith or evangelism or anything is to come at someone's behaviors. We speak to a behavior, change this about yourself. And that's how things get reduced to moralism in the Christian faith, is judging based on behaviors. And that's what we try to speak the gospel into. But we often find that isn't very helpful. We need to speak to the worldview, the thing that is underlying and driving a lot of people's decisions and the things that we're doing. It was Tim Keller who said that people have to want something to be true before they are open to an argument that it is, and that wanting, that desire is the longing. Barna did a survey. They looked at people and the things that they were wanting. And the number one thing that people were saying that they were wanting currently is inner peace. That was the highest percentage of people's desires. And it's interesting, you know, as I watch YouTube, for example, and you have all of these influencers who come out with these ads. And one of the things that they're promoting so much is BetterHelp. And BetterHelp is the online counseling service. I have nothing against counseling. I'm very for it. But it's very interesting how the world is even recognizing people's deepest needs, and they're speaking to it. They're saying, here's where you can find your answer. And maybe they truly do want to help people, but maybe they just want to make some money as well. But we're recognizing that people are speaking to people's deepest needs and not just their behaviors. And so we have to find a way to speak to people's needs and the thing that they're desiring. And so if I were just called to put this question back on you, what is it that people are longing for the most? What do you think is going on in people's minds, and how do we speak to it?
Yeah, I think that there's probably a, and I don't know that people know how to articulate it in the way I'm going to articulate it, but maybe one of the big questions that's out there is, what is worth wanting? You could ask somebody, you know, what do you want out of life? And they can take that question in 100 directions. But the question behind it is, well, what is worth wanting? So for instance, a lot of people would say they want to be happy. And it's kind of a thoughtless answer. It's almost reflexive. People will just, well, I want to be happy, or I want my kids to be happy. Is happiness worth wanting? Yeah, I mean, to a point, wouldn't we all rather be happy than despairing or depressed. But a lot of people will say, well, you know, what about the role of struggle? How about when you you know that you've gained a lot from your struggles or your kids' struggles, not that you would want any of that to be repeated, but you realize that some of the things you value the most are things you learned in struggle. So is struggle worth wanting? Well, nobody wants it, but we want the fruits of it. We want the resiliency that comes from it, the character depth, the dimensions to our personality. You don't usually get that if everything is just happy-go-lucky all the time. So I think people are wrestling with a sense of what's worth wanting. And they want inner peace. They don't necessarily know how to get it. You know, John Calvin talked about how the heart is an idol factory, and we make an idol of everything and just about anything. And so, you know, there can be an idolatrous pursuit of peace where I sort of go after that in a very self-centered, heedless of anything that doesn't look like that. I'm just going to give myself to anything that I want that feels peaceful to me. Drugs may feel peaceful to me. Getting drunk may feel peaceful to me. You know, having multiple sexual partners may be how I feel at peace. That would be idolatrous. But even the pursuit of ideology, when people are very partisan, that can be a pursuit of peace. I feel at peace when I'm with my own people, when I'm with my own tribe. And so it does take some effort in listening to people, again, to try to figure out what the motivation is this person is coming to life with, what they want out of life, and then how they think they should go about that. But they're, I think Keller, you know, gets that idea from Blaise Pascal, that sense that, you know, make good men wish that it were true, the gospel. And so how do you do that? How do you go about helping them emotionally and affectively grasp what oftentimes we carry as an intellectual kind of message, but it has to make emotional sense to people?
Yeah, and there are probably people listening that are going, how do I make this emotionally desirable? How do I go about that? How do I communicate the gospel in this way? But that's a question not easily answered. There is no silver bullet to convincing people or making this message attractive. Really, honestly, it's helpful, and we have to admit that people are complex, that and this should remove some of the onus from us and the pressure that we may feel from evangelism. But we need to admit that people are complex. They come with histories. They come with experiences and stories and expectations. And we have to learn how to communicate the gospel in a way that makes sense to a complex person. You know, we're talking about cultures and how to analyze a culture, how to break it down. And I think in some ways you can talk about an individual as a culture. They come with so much background, things that you have to learn to be able to talk with them effectively. You know, I used to live in West Africa, and when I got there, I had to learn the culture. I had to learn the language and how people lived. And just a minute ago, I handed something to you with my left hand, and I immediately internally regretted doing that. And so we become entrenched with a culture, and even with a person, we come to understand how they think and how they feel. And it is in doing that that we begin to understand how to communicate the gospel well to them. So we need to admit that people are complex.
Right. I think respecting the complexity is huge. People aren't simple. We're not brains on a stick. In fact, we're really more affective than we are cognitive. You know, people are feeling creatures more than we are thinking creatures. And understanding that, I think, slows you down a little bit, too. You know, I was trained in an evangelistic approach, as a lot of us were who've been to seminary. And this is no, I have nothing but appreciation for seminary. But I was, you know, trained in more of an academic kind of approach. I need to marshal reasons and evidence. And we do have to, and the gospel does have intellectual respectability. There's many brilliant people have believed and have found evidential answers for the questions that they struggled with about metaphysical questions, the question of whether the resurrection is actually a possibility, etc. and so on. But down at the feeling level, I only began to appreciate that a few years ago. And I think some of it was due to struggles in my own life and realizing, you know, does what I believe affect my affections? And helping people understand that the gospel is not an answer to all of our problems. But the gospel does introduce us to an answerer who promises to be with us in all things and to attend to us in all things and to even use our struggles and our sadnesses and our frustrations, the things that we hate experiencing, that somehow in his hands that's turned into fruit and further fodder for faith to develop and grow. And that's part of it, you know. I mean, the Bible was written by suffering people to suffering people. And I think we exegete culture, that's probably another thing that we notice is that this aversion to struggle and to suffering, we think we want to arrange our lives to where suffering can never touch us. And it's, we know we're lying to ourselves, but it's a comforting delusion. It's something that we kind of like the lie, because it's premised on, if I can't make sense of this thing that's happening in my life that I don't like, then there is no sense to be made of it. When things can have a higher sense than I can even reach, doesn't make suffering good, but the gospel brings a purpose and a meaning to your life where you're never again left in meaninglessness and purposelessness. You have a center, you have a core, you know God's in charge and God's bringing everything to his appointed conclusions. So things that don't make sense, that I don't understand, that I struggle with, and this is part of saying to people, respecting the complexity, says, that's okay to feel that. Godly people who've walked with the Lord for years and years still feel that. But our hope and our confidence is that God's promises in Christ are to make all wrong things right eventually. And we may have to wait till the very end to see some of the things that trouble us the most.
Yeah, if I were to go and quote from the late Tim Keller, as I did earlier, in the same conversation that he was having, he says that when we look at a culture, it is best that we need to find the plot line of the culture and give it a happy ending in Jesus. He sort of calls it a contradictive fulfillment, or a subverting and then fulfilling. We have to find that through line, that plot line of the culture. Where is it moving? Where is it heading? And then we need to take the gospel and communicate it in such a way that Jesus is the happy ending of that story.
Helping people understand that the author of the story is God in Christ. And Keller is fond of quoting Tolkien's character, Samwise Gamgee, in The Lord of the Rings. This wouldn't be a Christian podcast without a Lord of the Rings reference. That everything sad is going to come untrue. Keller was fond of using that quotation to essentially affirm the biblical direction that the world is not chaotic. It appears so because of the presence of sin, and that's one of the things we help people understand, that our faith does have a narrative to it. We're part of a story. People are storied creatures. We love stories. We think in terms of stories and narratives. And the conclusion God knows, and he has indicated to us that at the conclusion, everything that is sad comes untrue, meaning it's a beautiful way of putting it, as Tolkien put it, but that God is going to not ditch and toss away the world. He's going to ditch and toss away the things that trouble the world, the realities that make us sad, that make injustice a thing, etc. God's got a purpose in Christ, and the cross and the resurrection that followed it is a down payment. And it's the point at which the renewal of the world actually begins. And his patience with the world right now, that every day we have is a day God wants to bring people into his kingdom. When we grasp that, I think then sharing the gospel is less of a task that we have to make ourselves do. And it's more of a get to, you know. I'm looking at life on God's clock. And God's clock is he's bringing everything to an appointed end in his glory. And so sharing the gospel is how I tell time. I'm with people for now, for as long as I've got breath, as many days as I have. Let me be about the task of helping them understand their part in this great narrative that's rolling out.
Yeah, that's really good. We want to help people move from, you know, a fear of duty to a fear of missing out. We need to be excited about the get to. I get to share Jesus, right? Developing this sort of FOMO evangelism, as a friend of mine and I have called it once, you know, not a fear of missing out, that if I don't do it, that something bad is going to happen to me or God looks down upon me, but a fear of missing out in the sense of I enjoy talking to people about Jesus, and I'm sad when I don't take an opportunity or don't get to talk to someone about Jesus. We want to be excited about this opportunity. But also, as we kind of shift and think about this and proclaiming the good news, we need to think about our context and where we are, especially in a place like Nashville in the South, where, you know, it's oftentimes called the Bible Belt, but a large majority of the people that we're engaging with are nominal Christians, maybe not devout believers. But thinking about Nashville really sets the landscape for how we engage with people with the gospel. I used to live in Portland, Oregon, where if you wanted to think about having a conversation with someone about Jesus, it was oftentimes like trying to catch a skittish cat. That if any point in time in the conversation, somebody realized where we were going, if it was headed towards Jesus, they would just abruptly want to leave the conversation. That we oftentimes had to talk to them in such a way that they didn't know where we were going until we arrived. And then we were already in the conversation. Even if I was doing it in a very gentle and wise and non-abrasive way, that people were just really skittish to the topic in general. And so that changed and affected the way that I thought about engaging with people in conversation. But then if we turn and look at a city like Nashville, which is kind of made up of something different, it maybe changes the way that we think about sharing this good news with people in the city of Nashville. And so, you know, Cole, when you think about this place, what do we need to be thinking about? What, when we communicate the gospel to a city like Nashville, what changes? What changes the way that we are engaging with these people?
A few months ago, I went to a Barna, kind of Barna did a survey of Nashville, the state of Nashville, they called it. And they returned a number of figures and parsed through them. There was a bunch of ministers in the room and people who were in Christian leadership in various capacities, corporately and church level in Nashville. Something like 7 in 10 Nashvillians consider themselves Christians. Now, when you further parse that number down, I mean, that seems like a staggering high number. But it tells us the Bible Belt is still a thing. As they pared that number down, they said that 10% was what they called resilient disciples, which would be, I gather, you know, people who have conversations like you and I are having about how do we get the gospel to people. care about their walk with the Lord or committed to a church, maybe are leadership or in leadership in their church. So I remember years ago hearing a church in Texas make a distinction when they looked around at their community. They said, we've got a lot of God-fearers. And I've used that through the years. So you've got that 70% of people in Nashville, you know, say they're Christians. And I would say more to the point, they're God-fearers. You know, they have some sort of religious church background. And it's still woven into the fabric of who they are. It may be a good memory, but it just became irrelevant as they got older. It may be a negative thing, and they suffered in their church-associated context in some way. But I think anecdotally, Nashville, because it's in the Bible Belt, attracts a lot of disaffected from the church people, ex-evangelicals, you know, the de-churched, the deconstructing, that term gets used a lot. I think this is a particular hub for them because they still get proximity to what is familiar and even comforting in ways, even if it's something they feel like they've left behind. But they're in this, you know, city that's got all the amenities and all the entertainment options and so many young people, you know, opportunities to mix and mingle and connect and all that. And so I think in Nashville, it still probably works to ask somebody if they've got, you know, are you churched or do you go to a church? In our neighborhood, we've gotten to know people in our neighborhood. And we found that that wasn't, talking church with people here is not off-putting like it would be on the West Coast in a city like Portland. You can still get away with that in Nashville. But when you, even if you have a church discussion, don't assume because the person has some church, you know, church speak, that they have a relationship with the Lord. Because they may just be a God-fearer. That church in Texas that I got that from kind of got that from Acts. You know, looking at sort of how the apostles moved out with the gospel, they found a lot of Jewish God-fearers. And these weren't Christians. They weren't Christ followers as of yet. They hadn't connected who God is and who Jesus is as one and the same. So I think in Nashville, you're walking around a city that there's still a lot of corporate religion here. There's a density of churches that does lead to a lot of disaffection, but there's also still a spiritual interest. You can get on the topic with somebody a little easier about spiritual things and find that they're open. And if they shut you down, it might be because they've had a bad experience. They have had some, whereas in Portland, they're shutting you down, probably not because they've had any experience, but just they've ruled this out. This is not something that they care about.
Yeah, that's really good. I think there's a helpful idea here, and I've used this and didn't realize it was a book until recently, but it's titled Gospel Fluency, right? Where we're able to engage in any situation that we may find ourselves in and communicate the gospel to them because we were fluent in it, like we would be fluent in a language. And we can take our understanding of the gospel and speak it into a situation. And we can find ourselves in these types of conversations with great conversation starters. And, you know, and I have often thought about it this way, that if you see your non-believing friend on Monday morning and you say to him or her, you know, how was your weekend? They're going to tell you what they did, and common courtesy says to reflect that question back to you. So they're going to ask you how your weekend was. And as long as you're really intentional about saying, you know, yeah, yesterday morning, Sunday, we had church. It was really good. And, you know, this is maybe something that I experienced. You know, that's very personal to you. That's okay to say. And I think to reflect that question to them and say, hey, do you go to church on the weekend, or have you in the past at all? And, you know, I found that after that question is asked, you're often running to the races. People are probably willing to engage in some way, maybe not deeply intensely, but they're willing to engage just with that simple conversation starter, that you can find yourself in a non-abrasive way asking intentional questions about people. You are not forcing anything in any way. You're not even argumentative. While you may find arguments happening, you can do it in a gentle and kind way that invites this type of conversation with intentional conversation starters. And I think oftentimes people don't enter into these conversations because they have this deep underlying fear that the onus is upon them, that at any point in time, if they want to get to talk about Jesus, that they feel as though they need to share creation to Christ from beginning to end in that one conversation and then call for a response. And yes, we need to call for a response, but we're feeling the wrong onus when we begin the conversation, that is not necessarily what we're looking for, but that we can begin to enter into a conversation with someone without feeling like we have to get them to this radical point in the midst of it.
Show interest in people. And, you know, it's an old metaphor. It's as old as the Bible, about planting seeds. We shouldn't discount that. Sometimes just you really never know what the Lord can do with what you would think is the most non-effective. Well, that wasn't a good encounter. I didn't get to really share the gospel. But you maybe got them thinking about Jesus by just saying something about him, and they weren't thinking about him at all, and now they can't really get that out of their mind, and they keep thinking about it. It's almost like hearing a bit of a song, and it stays with you. And people shouldn't discount how God can use the smallest little seed scattered almost haphazardly in a conversation, maybe intentionally, but even if it's just kind of like, well, I ended up telling them I go to the gospel church and, you know, I'd love for them to go with me sometime. And 6 months later, the person comes back and says, I thought about that day you invited me to church, and they've forgotten about it. You know, I've forgotten that I invited you to church. I think I'd like to go. And you can have a conversation about that, but also just, you know, showing interest, respecting space, give people space to process. We're not in a hurry, you know. I mean, there's always been an old debate in evangelism circles of how much sense of urgency do we need to communicate. And if Christ's return is imminent, it would seem that we need to be urgent in making our appeal. And you do find urgency in the scriptures and the examples and the imperatives that are given to us. But I think if you have an overarching sense that God is moving all things to the conclusion in his glory that he has in mind, you don't have to be, you don't have to rush people, you don't have to hurry people. You can take time with them. And hopefully you've got people in your life that it's an ongoing conversation. It's not been shut down by them. If it is, okay, you know, there's not much you can do about that. It's probably nothing you did. It's probably something that's coming from their background. But for people who are willing to keep talking, find ways. This is where Christians should be educating themselves, reading after people who help us with how to do cultural exegesis. They're not hard books to read. They're great books to read. They've got plenty of anecdotes and plenty of good insights and turns of phrase that are memorable and helpful. If we're thinking about this, then we should seek out some equipping and to be effective at it. But effectiveness doesn't look like everybody I talk to turns to Christ. A lot of people I talk to will maybe make one little step in a positive direction, and you have to trust that God's in that and working through, even if I think my witness to them was a very tiny, the tiniest of seeds, and it hardly passes for a seed, God can make that grow.
Yeah. we referenced Barna earlier, and Barna did another survey where they were interviewing both people of faith and non-faith about how they perceive Christianity. What do you think about it? And a large majority of believers, and you would suspect this, said that Christianity is a faith you respect. But it's funny, when you look at the scale of what people are saying, from people of faith to non-faith, it just changes drastically to the highest percentage of non-faith people saying, oh no, Christianity is a faith of judgment. It's a judgmental one, or it's a hypocritical one. That is what people are perceiving about the Christian faith. Now, whether or not that is a correct interpretation is besides the point. It doesn't really matter, because that is how people are perceiving us, whether it's true or not. That when we're engaging with people, they see us as judgmental people. And I think that is even more pertinent in a place like the South, where many people are coming from church backgrounds, and many of them probably have de-churched themselves because they have found it to be a place of this intense moralism and judgment and full of hypocrites and bigots and whatnot. But that's what we're dealing with, is that is how people perceive us, that when we engage with them, they are just... We're being critical or we're judging or anything like that. And that's not to remove the fact that the Christian faith is one of judgment per se, that there is a consequence, that if you don't believe this, you know, we're dealing with those high stakes here. We won't ignore that. But that doesn't mean that we come in or we approach this message in a very abrasive or kind of hard knocks way, that we can do it in such a way that is kind and gentle and wise and speaks to people and what they're wanting. You know, Barna did another survey, and they found that the highest percentage of people of non-faith, the thing that they want from Christians when they're sharing their faith, is to listen without judgment. That's the number one thing that people want. However, in the same survey, they also found that even there was no direct correlation between someone doing that, listening without judgment or something like that, and then someone wanting to hear more about Jesus. There was no direct correlation. And so we're dealing with an interesting culture in which we may give them what they want, and then we don't know what they're going to do with it in the end. They may not even do anything positively with it. But that doesn't keep us or prevent us from listening without judgment or approaching our message in a way that people can receive. On the same end, this doesn't just mean that we, you know, there's the adage of build it and they will come. It's like we can take that into evangelism and say live it and they will come. But I don't think that's very helpful. We have to proclaim. We can't just live, but we can proclaim, and we can talk in such a way that we're doing so without judgment, in a way that people will receive and want to talk to us about. But we do have to recognize that people's starting point is one in which they view us as a faith of judgment.
Associate religion with moralism. Mm-hmm. And that's been around a long time.
Yeah.
And particularly if somebody's felt they've been burned by moralism, then it's really hard for them to detangle a faith message with that, because the sense is it's almost like you're trying to get me to walk into a spider web, and the spider web is your moralism. And if I become a Christian and I get involved in a church, now I'm going to have people trying to control my life. And they think that because there's been evidence through history up into the contemporary time of high control, high conformity expressions of Christianity. And those are very happy to take center stage and point to themselves as the way, because high control, high conformity, anything, not just Christianity, high control, high conformity, Islam, high control, high conformity, Hinduism, is very assertive and wants to dominate and domineer. And so, you know, helping somebody understand that the gospel is not fundamentally a domineering message whatever people have done in their communities, and Christian communities run a spectrum from, you know, almost communal, you know, everybody does their own thing here, to lockdown, high control, high conformity kinds of expressions. It's, you know, helping people understand the fundamental need they have before God to be reconciled to Him. And I think if we can, sometimes people want to talk issues with us. And, well, what does the church think about this? What do Christians think about this? And I think it's wise for us to say in return, happy to talk with you about that. But would you tell me what you think about resurrection? Whether you think that's possible. You're not switching anything on them. You're just saying, we can talk about that. But that's really not the central issue of, you know, the faith. The central issue of Christian faith is whether Jesus walked out of his tomb. And you ask somebody, do you believe that's a possibility? Now you're right at the heart of the gospel already. And sometimes you can do that when somebody says, well, you know, I want to know what the church thinks about gay marriage, or you know, why are Christians against homosexuality, you know, or why is the church so bigoted? And, you know, it's not like you're putting that off. You can actually come back around to that. But it's, instead of starting with issues and letting somebody determine, here's what we're going to talk about, especially when you get some of those issues like that, you can say, yeah, we can talk about that, but can we really talk about what's central to Christian faith, which is belief in the resurrection? And that puts the conversation on a whole different footing than just trying to talk about, you know, whether Christians approve this or accept that, etc.
Yeah, and I think people, before they enter into evangelistic conversations, they just live with this deep fear that prevents them from entering into a conversation because they're afraid of what's going to come up. They don't know the topic. And, you know, it could be something like gay marriage, and they don't know what to say. But we don't have to avoid the question, but we can redirect to a better question like the resurrection that really is going to, if this one is answered appropriately, then it's going to shed light on the other question and allow us to answer that well from a different perspective. And so we can do that. But on the other hand, I think we just need to all admit, and this has been said plenty of times before, that we can say, I don't know. And I think that kind of question is so helpful, especially in a place like the West, where so often Christians have just thrown answers out. When somebody brings up a thing, we just say something. And not even thinking through the logic of what we said, if it makes sense, or if we even believe it, we just regurgitate something. We just say an answer. But if we can show and say to someone, hey, this question that you're asking is really valuable to me. This is a really good and important question, and I don't feel like I have kind of the ability right now to answer that question because I want to answer it well. Do you mind if you give me a little bit of time and I go away, think about it, and then come back to you with kind of my thoughts on this question? I think people receive that well. It shows a lot of respect. I've been in conversations where I've done that and people have really appreciated it. And then I intentionally follow up and I bring it up again after I've thought about it. It just gives you time to go, oh, wow, maybe I haven't even thought about that. And I need to kind of go and think about this and what I believe about this so that I know. And then I can answer it well and enter back into this conversation. So saying I don't know can be really powerful, especially in our culture.
Yeah, that's really good, Tanner, because it's it also kind of gives yourself, I mean, I know we're nervous a lot of times. A lot of Christians I know are really nervous about, because the gospel is so precious to us, we don't want to get it wrong. And we have this sense like, if I get it wrong, then this person may never believe, and that's my fault. And if you can just kind of help people, man, keep breathing while you're having a gospel conversation with people. I think we're probably almost better talking. We talk about proclaiming and declaring and heralding, and the gospel's a message, and but almost just talking about gospel conversation. You know, most people want to have conversations about any sorts of all varieties of topics. This is a conversation we can have with people. You can ask them as simple as, do you have any spiritual beliefs? And then listen. And they'll tell you if they do. They'll tell you what their spiritual beliefs are. And oftentimes, if it's conversational, they'll, what are your spiritual beliefs? And you can say, I'm a Christian, and my central spiritual belief is that God revealed himself in Jesus, and Jesus lived the life we should have lived and died a death that we were facing the judgment of God, and in order to keep us from that and give us peace with God, reconcile us to our Maker. And now you're off and running. And it came out of just asking somebody, do you have any spiritual beliefs? Or you can ask somebody, you know, what I said earlier in the podcast, what do you want out of life? What thrills you the most? What scares you the most? You know, people don't mind having those conversations with us, and we don't have to be nervous about what if they ask me something I can't answer. Like you said, and it's, I just want to reiterate it for effect, for emphasis. That's your best strategy is not, you're not buying time. That's manipulative, to buy time and to go find an answer and come back. You're saying, you know, I don't know that I can capably answer that question in a way that respects your asking it. Can I have a week to either think through it or maybe do a little reading? And then you come back to them not with the answer, I have an answer to your question, but here's some angles, here's some things I've read, here's some things we can further talk about. Because, you know, I didn't want to be understood what I was saying earlier, that I'm dismissing people's issues, questions. But like you said, they're real keen to go there, and it becomes kind of a gotcha. You know, well, I know Christians, you know, are against gay people. Well, Christians aren't against gay people. We know that we're not against gay people. But that gets said to us, you know, you're against gay people. Now you're put on the defensive. There's no way to answer that without being defensive. And so it's not like you're trying to manipulate the conversation, but just take a breath and say, you know, I'm really not against gay people. And I can talk with you about kind of the Christian view of homosexuality and all that is around that. But, you know, if you want to have that conversation, could we also have a conversation about resurrection? And you know, it's not like you're trying to throw fastballs by them. You want them to get the hit, you know. But you're now putting the conversation on a little different footing. And I guess all that to say, we don't have to feel like we've got to be defensive about anything. And I think when people are nervous and afraid, they get defensive. And so if you can kind of take away your own anxiety and nerves and ask the Lord to help you with it, of course, just relax and just have a conversation with somebody, then I think you'll find that you're more pleased with the results, whether it results in somebody praying to receive Christ with you or not. You're pleased more in that, you know, I felt like I was making sense. I felt like I was understanding them, and the Lord will give you the word you need. But we also do need to avail ourselves of good equipping, and Christians are the people most in need of reading about our faith and trying to assimilate good information about our faith, and so that we've got some things in store for when we do have the conversation. Because even as I say resurrection, I'm sure there's some listeners going, I don't know how I talk about resurrection at all. I know I believe in it, but I don't know how to talk about it. There's so many resources, and they're not hard to, you don't have to get a PhD, you know, in the resources to be able to utilize them.
I like that. And, you know, I think as, you know, we just land the plane here, and on that note of, you know, our goal is to make sense. You know, we want to walk away and say, did I save anyone today? That we can't do that. Only Christ can. But can I walk away and say, yeah, I share the gospel and it made sense. I believe it made sense. That's what we're going for here today, is that we want to understand our culture, the people around us, so that we can communicate the gospel to them in a way that makes sense. Cole, thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation today. See you guys next time.